Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present former CIA analyst Mel Goodman, who assesses the partisan conflict triggered by the Nunes memo in what many fear is part of a gathering and dangerous constitutional crisis. Jacqueline Patterson, director of the NAACP's Environmental and Climate Justice Program, who talks about the disproportionate impact of climate change on women of color. And journalist Stephen Rosenfeld, who discusses the U.S. Supreme Court's important role in ruling on current cases challenging the partisan gerrymandering of congressional district maps. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Returning from a brief trade tour of China, British Prime Minister Theresa May faces a rebellion from members of her Conservative Party over Brexit negotiations with the European Union. A faction of Tory Conservatives favors joining up with the opposition Labour Party, who are advocating a new customs union with Europe. Many in the Labour Party want to schedule a second referendum to reconsider a British divorce from the EU. Two leading Tories, including former Chancellor Ken Clark, favor retaining a customs union with the EU, rejecting the position of Eurosceptics who backed Brexit. However, The Guardian newspaper reports that the issue has become a dividing line between supporters of a hard Brexit, who believe it would limit sovereignty and prevent the UK striking deals with non-EU countries, and supporters of a soft Brexit, who want to keep Britain's trading ties with the EU as close as possible. Supporters of a soft Brexit believe Labour's position will be crucial in creating a parliamentary majority for staying in the customs union, which could help solve the dilemma over trade across Ireland's border, which remains in the EU. Among Labour's base, there's increased overall support to remain in the EU, but many Labour supporters in the north of England and Midlands region still favour Brexit. In a sign of the growing influence of high-tech companies, Google spent $18 million last year to influence Congress, federal agencies, and the White House on issues ranging from tax reform, immigration, and net neutrality. According to the Washington Post, Google also weighed in on attempts to regulate online advertising, its core profit center. 2017 was the first year a tech company outspent other industries, such as energy corporations, the telecom sector, and military contractors, in lobbying Washington. Social media giant Facebook spent $11 million on federal lobbying in 2017, focusing on immigration and net neutrality rules. According to the Center for Responsive Politics, Google, Amazon, and Facebook combined nearly $11 million to protect net neutrality rules, while internet service providers like AT&T and Comcast spent the same amount supporting the Trump FCC's move to kill net neutrality. The tech industry's ballooning lobbying budgets may indicate that the companies will fight hard to protect the data they are collecting on Americans, said Alvaro Bedoya, executive director of the Center on Privacy and Technology at Georgetown University. Bedoya worries that the government will find it increasingly difficult to pass new and meaningful consumer protection laws. The expansion of CVS's corporate empire, including its recently announced bid to acquire insurance giant Aetna, is bad news for small locally owned pharmacies. CVS, which is accused of trying to put independent pharmacists out of business, operates a vast chain of pharmacies, and CVS Caremark, the nation's second largest pharmacy benefit manager, which negotiates directly with health plans over coverage and pricing for pharmaceutical drugs. Industry observers say this concentration of power is a disaster for competition and access, particularly in underserved communities. Adding a health insurer like Aetna would further strengthen CVS's control of the pharmaceutical market and narrow the networks people depend on for medical care. According to the American Prospect, CVS has cut reimbursements for prescription drugs, mostly impacting Medicaid-managed care. But a disproportionate share of independent pharmacist incomes comes from such plans. Over 90% of independents' revenue comes from prescription drug sales, unlike full-service chains that feature more consumer products for sale. And over half of those prescriptions are from Medicare Part D and Medicaid. The CVS merger with Aetna will bolster the company's plan to launch a chain of Minute Clinic walk-in centers for minor illnesses and injuries. If the plan goes forward, CVS Aetna can steer patients with its insurance and drug benefits to its own clinics and pharmacies. Doug Hoey, president of the National Community Pharmacists Association, warns that profits for the conglomerate will take precedence over the best interest of the patient. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
For the last few weeks, Washington has been focused on the controversial memo written by Devin Nunes, Republican chair of the House Intelligence Committee, which described alleged bias against Trump and improprieties by the FBI and Justice Department in the process used to obtain a FISA surveillance warrant targeting Trump campaign advisor Carter Page. While the FBI, Justice Department, former intelligence officials, and most Democrats condemned the decision by the House Intelligence Committee and White House to release the memo due to concerns regarding classified material, most of the information on the 3.5-page document had already been published. Although President Trump erroneously declared that the Nunes memo had vindicated him in allegations that he colluded with Russia to influence the 2016 presidential election, many observers have concluded that the memo, in fact, had backfired. In cherry-picking the information in his memo, Nunes misrepresented important facts and failed to discredit Special Counsel Robert Mueller's Trump-Russia investigation. House Democrats are now waiting for the White House to authorize the release of their own 10-page memo, which is said to refute the Nunes allegations point by point. Your reporter spoke with Mel Goodman, former CIA analyst and author who currently serves as a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy. Here, Goodman assesses the partisan conflict triggered by the Nunes memo in what many fear is part of a gathering and dangerous constitutional crisis.
The observation I have is based on 42 years of security clearances with CIA, the State Department, the Defense Department, the United States Army, for that matter. I've dealt with the military. I've spent time helping to train FBI officers. I've been at the CIA, the Defense Department. These are very conservative individuals who lead these institutions. They are, for the most part, Republicans. They're not Democrats. So the whole notion that somehow there's this deep state that's working within all of these institutions to compromise and even overthrow the president of the United States is really just an absurd notion. As for the Nunes memo itself, this is a very dangerous trend because it furthers the politicization of the intelligence committees on the Hill. And remember, these committees, like the FISA court itself, came out in the mid and late 1970s because of the crimes that were committed by the FBI and the CIA and the National Security Agency under the heading of COINTELPRO. These were the counterintelligence programs that were aimed at Americans who were in the anti-war movement, for example. So there were mail openings, there were illegal surveillance, there were wiretaps without warrants. So in the 1970s, after the Church and Pike Committee hearings, you got the creation of the Senate and the House Intelligence Committees and the creation with the FISA Act, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, the creation of the FISA Court, which had to approve any warrant, any surveillance of an American citizen. So with the Nunes memo, and clearly Devin Nunes has demonstrated that he's simply a stooge of the White House, a stooge of President Trump. He's trying to act as Trump's defense lawyer on the Hill. He's doing a pretty miserable job of it. Remember his midnight run to the White House to get documents that he claimed came to him from a secret source. It wasn't a secret source. It was someone in the White House giving him documents that the president's staff had already seen. And with this Nunes memo, you get a very one-sided account of the warrant that was issued to monitor the activities of Carter Page. And that's why the House Intelligence Committee voted, I believe unanimously, to release now the Democratic memo. And this is an unfortunate trend to have these dueling memos, but I think the Democrats had to go ahead and get on record their view of the evidentiary basis that's involved in the Nunes memo, because the Nunes memo is so one-sided and how these warrants were obtained. Now, the point that is really controversial in this memo is that without McCabe giving the Steele dossier to the FISA court, there would have been no FISA warrant. Well, that's a lie. I won't say it's false. It's a lie. The key issue in getting the warrant on Carter Page, who had been in the Trump campaign at some level, really that was the former campaign worker George Papadopoulos, who gave that information to an Australian diplomat, and we're told that the Australian diplomat was so concerned about the information he got from Papadopoulos that he gave this information to the FBI. I'm assuming that the FISA court had good reason to permit this warrant of an American citizen. However, what we've seen since 1978, 1979, when this court was created, and remember, it's a secret court without any way of challenging the court. They've received thousands of applications over the years, and maybe only a dozen of these applications were ever denied. So it raises certainly the obvious observation that the FISA court, to some degree, has become a rubber stamp for the FBI and the Justice Department. So I think we need to learn more about the FISA court.
Well, Mel, we only have time for one more comment, and I wanted to get your take on this. There's a lot of concern out there about a coming constitutional crisis in the United States, where various branches of government will be pitted against one another in this attempt, it appears, by the White House to marshal all its forces to try and discredit the Mueller investigation and put off, for the moment anyway, as they see it, some kind of event that will bring down this presidency. What are your concerns about a constitutional crisis?
Well, I think we're already in a constitutional crisis. You have a president of the United States who is not fit to serve, and he surrounded himself with authoritarian figures, mostly from the military. So the crisis is already there. Well, the problem is I don't think Democrats know what to do about it. They've been in a crisis, frankly, since the Republicans said they weren't going to give Merrick Garland a hearing as a nominee to the Supreme Court. I think really was the signal that the Democrats are in for a real battle, and I don't think they're in a position to wage it with any great strength, because they're a diverse coalition to begin with, the way a political party should be. And they're up against this old white man Republican party from another time that I think over the long run is going to fail, but in the short term is going to cause a lot of friction and tension in American political life.
That was Mel Goodman, a former Soviet analyst at the CIA and author, who currently serves as a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy. Goodman's latest book is titled Whistleblower at the CIA. For more perspectives on the Nunes memo and the Trump-Russia probe, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The 145th American Public Health Association Conference drew 12,000 people to their annual gathering in Atlanta, Georgia, for 4 days in early November 2017. The conference theme was climate change and public health, where dozens of workshops, panels, and plenaries were organized to address that topic. One of the conference panels was titled Women and Climate Change, where three women made presentations on various aspects of how climate change impacts women first and worst, both in the U.S. and globally. One of the panel speakers was Jacqueline Patterson, director of the NAACP's Environmental and Climate Justice Program. Her talk dealt with the double jeopardy of race and gender that women of color face in human-induced natural disasters, such as hurricanes, droughts, and floods. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus attended the panel discussion and brings us this excerpt of Patterson's talk.
The historical roots of climate change rooted in patriarchy include the rampant extraction and exploitation of both human and natural resources. And then we see it institutionalized in our trade, manufacturing, finance policies that benefit corporations and industrialized nations, as opposed to really looking at human rights for all. And so when we talk about some of the impacts of this in terms of frontline communities who are feeling these impacts now, we know that with our extraction, whether we're extracting coal, which in the context of mining, 76,000 coal miners have died of black lung disease since 1968, while year after year the National Mining Association fights against the very regulation that would have protected those workers from coal mine dust so that they can continue to maximize profits without any regard to human rights and even human life at all. And so, and even as we make this transition, we talk about transitioning to natural gas, which has its own perils, as we all know, in terms of fracking. And all of these practices disproportionately impact women. And so when we talk about the effects of pollution, air pollution, water pollution, soil contamination, all gets into our bodies through what comes out of the smokestacks, what gets into our waterways through runoff or releases, and then also what gets into our soil, whether it's via acid rain or through runoff or otherwise. And this all impacts our bodies in different ways, and particularly women's bodies as it relates to some of what comes out of smokestacks, particularly coal plants and oil refineries and so forth, include endocrine disruptors, which has an impact on our reproductive systems. And so as we begin to talk about some specifics, because I want to really root us in not just kind of the statistics and the general stories, but also who is being impacted. This is a woman named Annie who lived in North Carolina, and she was recording in her neighborhood. She was doing her own independent health survey where she was going around speaking to her neighbors and then making notations about illnesses that she was finding in her community. And in that, on that notepad, you see the list of names, and next to them you might see a little notation, and those are D's for people who over time were deceased as she was doing the survey. And when I was doing this presentation 3 months after I met her in North Carolina, when I showed her picture, there was kind of a rumble in the crowd. And then I asked what was going on, and they said that just a couple of weeks before that, she herself had passed away. And she told me when she was talking to me that she was also feeling the health impacts of this exposure to coal ash in her community. And when her husband walked in, she kind of started talking lower because her husband actually worked for the company that ran the coal-fired power plant in the community. So we see how in terms of both the health impacts, physical health impacts, but even relationship and mental health impacts of living in those situations and being a defender of human rights in those contexts. In the aftermath of the disaster that happened around the Flint water crisis, we saw female-headed households who were significantly impacted by not having the mobility to be able to move, being the caretakers for their families, particularly some single women-headed households. And this is one family where it's a family of a woman and three kids, and they're relying on 151 bottles of water per day to just do their daily activities for life. And so there was story after story that was similar in terms of, and again, we talk about the physical burdens as well as the mental health burdens that women face in these contexts. And another situation that we talk about is in the oil extraction process. People may have heard of man camps that happen in North Dakota and South Dakota, where they're camps where people come together for the extraction industry, the oil and gas industry, and it's all men living in those places. What often doesn't get told is the story of the women, largely indigenous women, largely women of color, who are disappeared in those situations and who face sexual assault in those situations often as well. And so this is another piece along the climate change continuum, both the drivers and the impacts that disproportionately impacts women. And so as we talk about the results of climate change, whether it's sea level rise that's displacing folks across, in different places in coastal regions, places like the Pinellas County in Florida, Thibodaux, Louisiana, the Kivalina in Alaska are also facing imminent displacement within 20 years because of sea level rise. And already one community, the Ile de Jean Charles Band of the Biloxi, Chinamaca, Choctaw tribe was also displaced because of sea level rise. And as we see shifts in agricultural yields, we know that women in the United States and across the world are more likely to be food insecure, and particularly female-headed households are more likely to be food insecure. That actually has a deadly impact because women are facing extreme increases in domestic violence because agriculture is seen as the role of women in some societies, and it is resulting in violence against women that they aren't able to fulfill their roles because of the shifts in agricultural yields.
That was Jacqueline Patterson, director of the NAACP's Environmental and Climate Justice Program. Find links to related articles and information on this topic by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. As Democrats gear up for this November's 2018 midterm election, hoping to take over the U.S. House of Representatives and possibly the Senate, the issue of gerrymandered congressional district maps has become an ever more important issue. Back in 2010, Republicans focused their electoral effort on taking over state legislatures from coast to coast, with the prize being the right to redraw congressional district maps based on census data that's gathered every 10 years. The Republicans' Red Map Project, as it was called, was a success. Once the maps were redrawn to provide GOP candidates a partisan advantage, Republicans have had a lock on controlling the House of Representatives. However, in recent years, lawsuits have been filed challenging the constitutionality of partisan gerrymandering in Wisconsin, Maryland, and Pennsylvania. In Pennsylvania, where Republicans hold 13 of 18 congressional seats due to gerrymandered districts, a lawsuit resulted in the state Supreme Court striking down the congressional map. Republicans appealed the decision to the U.S. Supreme Court, but on February 5th, the High Court declined to hear the case. Now the GOP-controlled legislature must draw new maps by February 15th. Your reporter spoke with Stephen Rosenfeld, who covers democracy and voting rights issues for Alternate.org. Here he discusses the challenges to gerrymandering in Pennsylvania and the U.S. Supreme Court's role ruling on other important partisan gerrymandering cases that could determine which party controls Congress.
In 2011, the Republicans in Pennsylvania, like many other states, they just went crazy. They didn't draw maps based on logical things like county lines or school districts or urban centers, so that if you're a member of Congress, you represent a constituency. They went down to the neighborhood and block level using all the information that the people now know is out there. And they basically segregated the voters by party. And as a result, and this is what gerrymandering is about, the Republicans gave themselves districts where they could win with 55, 56, 57% of the vote based on their most reliable voters. And they made sure that the Democrats never reached those numbers. And then they took the Democrats where they were, and they made sure they would win with 65, 70%. So they call it cracking and packing. And over this last decade, there's been a ton of litigation in a lot of states, and it's just been simmering along. And now it's finally worked its way to the state Supreme Courts. And in Pennsylvania, there was a very unusual decision. It didn't involve any federal law whatsoever. And last week, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court told the state legislature, you have to redraw these maps. It violates our state constitution. And, of course, the Republicans said, well, we're going to appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. And the U.S. Supreme Court said, no, we're not going to touch it. What that means is that it's supposed to be a fast-track process where the Pennsylvania legislature is supposed to come up with new maps. And if they don't come up with new maps, then the state Supreme Court is going to have an expert, this Stanford law professor, draw the maps. And what we've seen so far, and this is what's been the pattern in every other state in recent years where Republicans have been told to redraw the maps, they're dragging their feet, they're ignoring court deadlines, and they're just trying to drag out the process so that the maps that they drew initially just hold, you know, through the next election. So it'll be really interesting to see what happens in the next literally couple of weeks, because it looks like the state Supreme Court in Pennsylvania is going to step on the Republicans and draw maps because they're not going to do it, they being the Republican legislators.
Summarize for our listeners, what are the important cases that the Supreme Court will hear in the coming months that will determine whether or not we see an end to this extreme partisan gerrymandering?
Well, the biggest case comes out of Wisconsin, and it concerns the state legislature. And there the question is whether they're going to accept this standard based on what they call wasted votes. And it's for us, it's for the entire legislature. So it's not just a couple of seats. The next one that's big, the Republicans took a case where there was the one example of a Democratic gerrymander. It was in Maryland, and it concerned one congressional seat. It wasn't the entire state delegation. The next ones that come out that are really big are in Texas. There's the use of race to create the congressional districts there, but they're probably not going to issue a decision until late in the spring, which means it won't affect 2018. And the same thing is true with North Carolina, where, again, once again, the Republican legislature was ordered by a federal court to redraw the maps, and they refused, and the Supreme Court said, okay, we'll finally take the case. So that means it freezes it. So those are the big ones. The lower courts in North Carolina said the Republicans went after voters by race with surgical precision. That was their quote. So this is what we're dealing with here.
What are the critical factors you think at play here? And I think you summarized many of them, but if you had to distill it down, what will determine if we're going to have some even playing fields in the future of American politics, or whether we're going to have this rigged system for many years to come? Is it the will of progressive activists? I mean, is it courts? Is it money? What do you think it is?
Well, it's a really great question. I think this gerrymandering thing and map drawing is a really big thing, because it's not the elephant in the living room, it's the living room. If the Republicans have a built-in 6-point to 8-point advantage, and these statistics don't just come from me, they come from the best statisticians and academics, that's a very high wall to get over. And then it becomes a question of voter turnout. And the blue states and the red states, they might as well be different countries. It's very hard to get people to register and to turn out and to vote in a lot of these red states. It's not the same as a lot of the blue states. But once again, it comes down to voter turnout on election day, and then hoping that the process is transparent enough so if it's close, the ballots can be, can be verified, the vote can be verified. That's all we've got. I've been around, this kind of politics for decades, and this is what it basically comes back down to.
That was Stephen Rosenfeld, who covers democracy and voting rights issues for Alternet.org. His forthcoming book is titled Democracy Betrayed. Find more analysis and commentary on the issue of partisan gerrymandering by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, WHYS in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, KDNK in Glenwood Springs, Colorado, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.